Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the virtual Wood Profcast. And you might ask why I'm speaking English today, because the first two editions of our podcast were in German language. And for the future, we principally also plan it in German language. But from time to time, the issue needs another approach. And we have one lead question for the moment. What's going on in the US markets? And we are so happy that we have for years, and I think last year we counted it, Bob, for 14 or 15 years now, Bob Smith from Virginia Tech, who is one of the most profound professors in forest products marketing in the United States. So he found the time to talk to us about the actual situation in the United States at the moment, and we get the first-hand information about what's going on. And I've chosen this question because some 40 years ago, Marvin Gaye was singing this wonderful song. Bob, thank you very much that you found the time to talk to us. And I'd like to start with the first question. Can you give us in a brief an explanation what's going on now in the markets? We just see that the price for some sortiments went up by 4 times, for some sortiments even by 5 times. So if we would have talked 3 days ago, the curve of the wood would have been even steeper than with Bitcoin, but we see all those cryptos just crashed in the last 24 hours. But the wood price is still high again. Bob, can you give us a short explanation what's going on now?
Oh, sure. Well, first of all, Gunter, thank you very much for having me join you today. It's always a pleasure to visit with my friends over there. And hello to your class. I know this is a new trial for you, and I hope it goes very successful. Yeah, the U.S. currently has what we would call the perfect storm for wood pricing. And we have a number of factors impacting our lumber prices. And it started about a year and a half ago when the pandemic started and everyone was forced to stay home. And they started taking a look at their homes and decided, well, we could repair this. So our repair and remodeling industry really took off. And yesterday and today, Lowe's just announced again, our home major home centers just announced again, record earnings for the last quarter. And so we have a number of factors impacting lumber prices. One is, of course, the increased demand in repair and remodeling. We have increased new home building. We reached over 1.3 million single family homes, which is the most in a number of years. We have a whole generation that has had postponed buying homes, and they are currently moving into the marketplace. So that's increasing. We have record low interest rates, and that has been driven by the Federal Reserve here, and they don't look like they're going to move at least for another year. And so we can purchase a home for anywhere between 2.5% and 3.5% interest rates right now. Then we have issues with the crazy weather around the world, and so we have very wet weather in the south, and that impacts harvesting. We have issues with pine beetle in the western United States and Canada that basically reduces log supplies. Then during the pandemic, we had a lot of mills shut down, so we had less production coming out of mills. So ultimately, it comes down to what they teach you in economics, the supply and demand issue. And we have a reduced supply as an increased demand. And so that's currently the short answer to what's happening. And I should add, the housing market in the United States drives our wood industry. About 2/3 of our softwood lumber and 1/2 of our grade hardwood lumber go into the housing market.
So. Okay, Bob, this sounds pretty complex to me. But before I start my question, Günther, I don't have to agree with you. The first two podcasts weren't in German language. Only the first one were in German. The second was definitely in Austrian language. So... But let's see, or let's have a look on this mountain, what you just described, Bob, and split it into several hills, small hills. And I'm originally a forester, and I see the situation in Europe. We have three very dry summers and hardly any rain, and we have a lot of problems with drought and bark beetle, etc. And additionally, on top, I heard in the United States you have millions of hectares of forest fires as well. Is this problem, the climate problem, which destroys millions of hectares of forest, the origin of all these circles, or is it just one part of the big hill?
I would say that's one part of the big hill. It's important. Certainly the forest fires out west and our under management of our national forests out west have reduced the supply. Historically, the Pacific Northwest, the main Doug Fir region of the United States, was our largest producing region. And probably about 15 years ago, that all moved down the southern United States. We introduced in the 1970s multi-use forestry. So, we only didn't manage forests for timber. We managed it for recreation. We managed it for wildlife. And so it reduced big time the harvest. And that actually not harvesting and not managing our forests led to the accumulation of debris that leads to the massive forest fires. And so that led, and right now the South is, the leading producer of timber in the United States. And so that, but yeah, that's certainly one of the issues. And also by not harvesting and the dying timber led to the bark beetle.
We also have the issue with the bark beetle. And in the last podcast, we had one of the leading owners of a big forest products industry in Austria. And we were discussing about the most dynamic situation in the last 50 years. And just a year ago, we had far too much low quality wood because of the bark beetle. The foresters got nearly no money. And then the sawmillers and the producers of all building products, they were printing money in the last year. This year, we now have the situation that with even on the supply side, because of lower motivation of the foresters, there's a demand issue. And on the other hand, we have a lot of customers in Europe. Building with wood is more popular than ever. And additionally, we have China and we have the US now as new big customers or old customers coming back again. And now we have the issue that we have an intensive lack of wood all over Europe now. So we have some short-term factors, but we obviously also have some long-term factors. Bark beetle, you had starting the problem already, I think, some 10, 15 years ago in Canada. And we have the impact right now. You talked about one generation of having not built houses. So this was obviously after the crisis of 2008. Mm-hmm. How long will this situation we face right now go on? Is it just a short-term special spike of the markets, or is there also a longer ongoing trend? How do you see it?
It's a great question, Gunter, and if I knew the answer to that, I would probably go out somewhere else and make a fortune. But my guess is, and the other experts in the country believe that the prices are going to last probably 1 to 2 more years. And we have a strong demand for housing. The demographers in the United States will say that we could build 1.4 and 1.5 million single-family homes for the next 20 years. That's the demand out there. And so, and as interest rates stay low, people are trying to capture that. So historically, our prices, fluctuate quite heavily. And so My guess would be that they will remain high for at least another year and a half. They'll come down, but normally after the bounce, they don't come back to what they were. And so they, historically our prices for our dimension lumber that we build homes were about $350 to $400 a thousand. And, right now they're pushing $1,400 and $1,500 a thousand board feet. And so we're looking at if they come back to about $500-$600 a thousand in a couple of years or a year and a half. And then they'll probably, at that time, the marketplace will probably start leveling itself out to a normal trend. You know, the average price of a home in the United States now went up $30,000 to $45,000 just based on lumber, and they can't get the lumber. I visited my son last 2 weeks ago in D.C., and he has a fella he works with, one of his colleagues, couldn't find a home to buy in the Washington, D.C. area, and so they put a contract to build the home, and the contractor told them, you can have the home, but we can't get it to you within 2 years. So he had to put a deposit of 10 or 15% down in a home that he won't see for 2 years, and they couldn't guarantee the price because of the price of lumber. They kind of gave them an area that it could end up in. So that's kind of the fluctuation we're facing right now.
I just have had the same experiences. As a hobby, I'm selling plant material from Germany to Denmark, and we just made a contract this week, and we fixed the price for the situation. But before the delivery, let's say in 8-9 weeks, the seller or the supplier can't guarantee the prices. So the prices can change within the 9 weeks, but the buyer is not allowed to cancel the contract if the prices collapse. So he has to take the material no matter what the price is then. That's really weird, I would say.
Yeah.
Günther and I, just the last 2 days, we took part in an international forest and agriculture investment conference. And it was quite interesting because they expect that the forest land and agricultural land, that this will develop within the next 10 years quite extremely to higher prices as today. And they are a bit scared, or they fear a bit the regulations from the states, like the climate regulation, the harvesting regulation, etc. Mm-hmm. Do you have such information as well from the United States?
Yeah, you know, the U.S. is a little different because about 2/3 of our forests in the eastern United States are privately held. And so they have to practice best management, and each state regulates that. But at the national level, the only thing our national government can really do is impact our national lands, which are predominantly lands in the western United States, our softwood in the western United States. So from an environmental standpoint or regulatory standpoint, at the federal level, we don't have a lot of control over private lands. In fact, we take our private land ownership pretty serious in the United States. And so, the states require best management practices on the forest. So if you're going to harvest timber on the forest, you got to harvest it properly. We don't force landowners to have management plans. We highly recommend it. And we have people that can assist them developing management plans. But we do not, we don't have anything that says you have to manage your forest to this criteria at the private level. So I don't see that. I mean, anything could happen. But I don't see that at the federal level happening. So.
Just to get another insight into your market, one of my assumptions why now the demand in the US is so high is it, you can contradict it, that your political system up to a certain extent changed with the last election? If now that the federal government is giving each person $1,400 just for boosting up the economy, that's a lot of buying power additionally in the market. And this may end up in the DIY and in the renovation sector. On the other hand, there is obviously this initiative of Biden to polish up the American infrastructures, and these are enormous investments that will also, of course, now that's just the planning phase, but those big projects will start in 2, 3, 5 years and will then cause an additional demand also in wood as material. How do you see that development?
Yeah, Günther, I hadn't thought about all of the relief we received during the pandemic as far as going to home construction, but it's possible some folks they all of a sudden, if you get a family of four, you got another $3,000, so, you might have funds. So it's possible that influenced it. I don't think that was the intent of it, but I think, there's certainly certain people could use it for that. Certainly the infrastructure bill could help the forest products industry. That's really, you know, concrete, you know, highways and technology and those type of things that they're looking at. So I don't know exactly if it'll create a big demand for wood, but, you know, I used to sell highway construction products. And in the United States, for every mile of road you build, there's about 8,000 or 9,000 board feet of lumber tucked around. And, you know, from guardrails, utility poles, piling and those things. So there could be some driving. Certainly when you throw that amount of money, you know, they're talking $2 to $3 trillion. Some of it could impact the industry. So if, you know, they start trying to shore up housing, which they could do, you know, we have a lot of need for low income housing. And that's, you could tie that into infrastructure. And that could have a big impact on our industry. So, you know, all of those tied together could lead to certainly increased demand for our products.
In the last years, we did two projects when we looked at the development of CLT here in Europe and now the market introduction in the US. Do you see a change in the customer behavior in the US? Because on the one hand, we would be happy if so many people would build their residences with wood. So we have around about 30% wood as building material. I think you have 85% or so. On the other hand, obviously, we use higher qualities and more sophisticated materials if we build. And is there also a tendency in the US to use more prefabrication, to use more CLT, to use more engineered products?
Yeah, I would say we're moving to that. And I think we're going to move toward more in-plant assembly of homes, which will, and that's all driven by labor. Contractors cannot find labor. So we can build it in a factory and ship parts out into the factory, from the factory to the homes. I think we're going to see increase in that. CLTs are really becoming popular in commercial construction right now in the United States. 5 years ago, we had two plants starting up in the Western United States with CLTs. And currently we have 16 plants in North America. And we have five on the planning blocks to be. So, you know, within a year or two, we're going to have 21 CLT plants in the United States located in our wood basket. You know, there's a number out west in the Doug Fir. We have a number here in the Southern Yellow Pine. And there's some up in the Canadian, North America, U.S. border where we have spruce pine fir resource. We have over 1,000 projects either in progress or going up right now, predominantly all commercial buildings with CLTs. And there has been estimates that if the CLT market takes off strongly in the just the 8-story and below commercial buildings, we could use another 3 to 4 billion board feet in CLTs construction in those buildings alone. We have not seen CLT a lot in private homes yet, but I think it's just a matter of time. You know, once the industry figures out to drive costs down at the plant, you know, this is all introductory right now. We have to have the learning curve. But once they figure that out, I think we're going to see more CLTs in home construction.
How big is the price difference at the moment between a standard timber frame and a CLT residence house in the States?
I haven't seen direct numbers. I've heard, you know, 20-25% more with a CLT. You know, our traditional home is 2x4 frame construction and then plywood roofs and floors and OSB sidings. Though, you know, that's our typical home. And most of the, you know, the standard framing material is spruce SPF, spruce pine fir. And then we use Southern Yellow Pine as joists and in truss material. We normally don't use a lot of Southern Yellow Pine in stud material. It's a little harder wood, so SPF teaches much better. Basically goes together much better.
Günther already mentioned it before, you had the elections and then now you have a new government, and you just mentioned that you have thousands of new projects. Is this somehow connected to each other? Is Biden investing quite a lot or starting new programs to convince those people who haven't elected him, who have voted for Trump, that there will be a new dynamic in the United States, that in 4 years' time, there will not so many disappointed, let's say, white unemployed people anymore? Is it somehow connected, your elections and all these programs you just talked about?
Yeah, I mean, certainly everything's interconnected at Washington, D.C., and they don't make any decision without looking who's going to help them get elected for the next 2 or 4 years. I mean, that's every, you know, and once you get over the cynical part about politics here, then you can take a look at, okay, you know, infrastructure is something that is easy to ignore until something bad happens. It's just, you know, it's very expensive, so people tend not to do maintenance on it. And so, you know, we've been talking about infrastructure here for 20 years, have a major infrastructure bill probably for 20 years, and we've never got it through. Biden has the advantage in a way, you know, he has to try to do everything he can in his first 2 years, because there's a good chance that Republicans will either take the Senate or the House back, okay? And then it just becomes a stalemate, all right? Because nobody wants to do anything. So, you know, Biden has total control, our president has total control of the House and Senate, I mean, the party has control of the House and Senate right now. Well, what they're trying to do is get everything through. To answer your question, Hubert, yes, you know, they're trying to spend money to help their country with the indirect impact, saying that, well, you know, this is what the Democrats have done for you, you know, so vote us again back in. I mean, you know, that's not their, I'm not going to say that's their purpose. You know, their purpose is to help the American government, but I mean, help us. But in the back of somebody's mind up there, they know darn well if they do well, you know, they're going to get reelected.
So my next question would be, you talked before about low income buildings. Mm-hmm. And we face now the situation that the building costs, on the one hand, the land plots, the prices increased enormously in our region, combined with very high building material costs and increasing labor costs, housing or building is more expensive than ever, so that the average young person can't afford owning a living anymore. And then we now look to the States, for example, to Katerra, because that's a new innovative company that creates standard building systems. And maybe those standardized, and not everything is individualized and therefore more expensive, those standardized systems are seen as one solution for how we also could build in the future. Mm-hmm. Do you see a market in cheaper living, building, housing costs via those systems?
Yeah, I think there's a great opportunity at the lower end of the market to do that, either with prefabricated module homes or the Katerra system. Yeah, I think there's a big market. You know, the average home in the United States right now, the medium priced home in the United States right now is about $340,000. The average two family income in the United States is about $60,000, right? So there's a big gap between, you know, if you look at your, about 30% of your income goes to housing, right? That's kind of what the experts will tell you. And so there's a big gap between that. So entry level housing, there's a real strong need, and that's certainly where the prefabricated home or whatever module home would have a, and there is a real strong need for that, because, you know, once somebody gets in a home, it's much easier to move up, but you got to get that $200,000 to $300,000 to get into the first home, and for young couples that's becoming more and more difficult. But yeah, to answer your question, I think it's a great opportunity.
When I came to timber business, it's now 22 years ago, I had my own timber importing agency in Hamburg, in northern Germany. And at that time, there were many German companies, importing hardwoods from the United States. Nowadays, we just only talk about exporting softwoods to the United States. But maybe, if I understand right, you are in the area where mostly hardwood sawmills or hardwood is growing. Maybe you can tell us something about the hardwood market in your area, especially, or in the United States in general.
Yeah, the hardwood industry, again, has been very cyclical. Last year, it was down actually about 15%. Hardwoods, again, are normally used. Upper grades are used in furniture, flooring, molding, and millwork. Lower grades are used in industrial products like ties, pallets. in those areas. We went from, you're absolutely right, Hubert, 20 years ago, Europe was our leading export. All the regions in Europe were our leading export of hardwood lumber. And today, I think maybe one or two countries are still, we're still exporting a sizable volume to, but otherwise we're not. What happened here, of course, is our furniture industry in the 90s moved over to China. And so our hardwood industry followed them over to China. Historically, we would normally export about 10 to 11% of our upper grades of hardwood lumber to common and above hardwood lumber total. Today, the export market is ultimately our leading market for upper grade hardwoods. Half of that for many years were going to China. Under our previous administration, we started trade wars. So that reduced the amount to China by about 50%. So about a quarter of our wood right now goes to China. Up again, I'm talking upper grades. But growth has come in Vietnam, has made up some of that, and some other Asian countries have made up. Mexico is a growing market for us. But overall, the furniture industry the last few years have been relatively flat. Cabinet industry has been relatively flat. The flooring industry has grown some. About 90% of our hardwoods are produced east of the Mississippi River. So this is all predominantly privately held land. And so the pallet industry is our stable industrial market. About close to 40% of the hardwood lumber goes into pallets. And pallets are a consistent market, and then railroad ties are a pretty consistent market on the industrial side. But hardwood overall has went down. Again, part of it was market. Part of it is a lot of companies went out of business during the pandemic and even prior. They never recovered from the 2009-10 recession. So we're seeing consolidation. You know what happens during when times are tough. You see consolidation, and we're still seeing consolidation in our hardwood industry. So the bigger mills are owning more mills, or the smaller mills are. Where we used to have, a lot of small hardwood sawmills producing 2 or 3 million board feet, you no longer can compete at that level anymore. And so you end up with larger mills. It may or may not happen. Our softwood industry, top 10 softwood companies in the United States produce, 60 to 70% of our softwood lumber. Weyerhaeuser's and GP and all those major corporations. And, there's going to be a day where, it may not be that drastic, but there'll be a day where the hardwood industry has, 6 or 7 major players. So, but yeah, the hardwood industry, and again, their production has been down, was down about 1.5 billion feet last year. Again, driven heavily, by the housing industry.
I try to connect now some strings of our story from before. We had in our first two podcasts one guest from the forest sector who said, we will lose the spruce in our German-speaking world, so at lower altitudes. There will be, in the long term, the demand that we switch to other species. That means hardwood be a construction material in the future again. We had the manager of the forest products industry who said, so in his strategy, he still sees softwood available for him in his plans. Mm-hmm. How do you see the situation in the States? So on the one hand, there is obviously the shortage of the material in the market. Mm-hmm. But if you are coping with an industry that is, after the 2008 crisis, still recovering, is there a power of innovation? Is there research going in the direction to use hardwood also as building material?
At this point, that's been tried. Since I've been at Virginia Tech, that's probably been tried 3 or 4 different times with our researchers here. And certainly, in general, hardwoods are stronger than softwoods because they're denser, they have higher specific gravity. We've done research here looking at low density hardwoods used in CLTs. They work fine. There's no issue with it. My issue, I have a couple issues, but if softwood prices stay high, it may not be an issue. But traditionally hardwoods sell for, a lot more than softwoods. And so the question always becomes, why do you put what I'm going to call somewhat more of a specialty product into a commodity market such as softwoods? That becomes. Second of all, our softwood hardwood mills saw a timber totally different than our softwood mills. Our softwood mills are just very high tech, just like your mills, right? You put a log in one end, nobody touches it, it comes out dried on the other end with a whole, you know. Sawmills used to employ a lot of people, but the softwood mill, no, they don't employ anybody, basically. The hardwood mills are not as, they're catching up, but they're not as technology advanced. And that, you know, so we're going to see more technology in the hardwood mills. It's just more complicated, you know, when scanning technology. I mean, so when you start scanning hardwood logs, how do you pick out the grades and how do you, you know, softwood mill, you know, you take out, you know, pick off the sides and you run everything very fast through it. And so it's, so technology will advance in the hardwood mills. I'm beating around your question here, Gunter, not on purpose, but, you know, we've done work here as yellow poplar tulip wood. You know, we had a guy build a home here out of tulip wood. It works fine, right? But again, we can sell tulip wood to you folks for a dollar a board foot. You know, in traditional construction, lumber softwood is 40 cents a board foot. You know, economically, it doesn't make sense. Now, the day may come when it will. And then the whole sawing process, the mentality of sawing a hardwood versus a softwood in the mill. You know, a number of years ago, there was a strong push for timber bridges in the United States out of hardwood, similar like what we're trying to do with CLTs right now. But low volume bridges and highways made out of timber, but of hardwoods. And there's no problem in doing it, but we couldn't get the mills to saw 3-inch by 12-inch lumber because they can make so much more money sawing grade lumber. And so the economics of that. Now, if we run out of softwoods, yeah, then we have no choice. And, you know, one thing over time, you'll learn that the market will always go to the resource. So if we don't have, if you don't have spruce, they're going to find something else. So
I want to add a question exactly to this topic. Bob, you are in a technical university, so I guess you are the exact person who can answer me the question. In the conference we just joined the other day, there was one sentence which quite impressed me. I have written it down here, so to read it. The most typical wood product is waste, one of the persons said. The most typical wood product is waste. If we think about burning about 90% of our hardwoods in Germany, we bring it directly from the forest to the oven. We produce paper which we just throw away after usage. Aren't we forced to find new technology or new products if we on one hand have huge problems with raw material and softwood side, and which we, on the other hand, with a huge demand for wooden products, so we are just forced to use or to start new technologies. I know you said it before, you don't have the crystal ball to look into it, to make a prospect to the future, but can you give us some ideas or at least some hope where the journey will go on?
Sure. I mean, it's a great question, Hubert, great statement. I believe the future and the generation that's currently going to be the future customer in this area we'll be looking at the environment, long-term environmental impact of all of our products. Okay, I don't think we're there quite yet, okay? But I do believe, you know, in the future, we will be taking a look at not only when you build that home, what are you going to do with it when it comes out of service? You know, our homes here last 70 to 100 years, our stick-built homes. So what are we going to do with it? And this is where you really see the advantage. I see the advantage of CLTs. Okay, so you can build that building with the intent that when the building's purpose has been served, you can take the CLTs and use them again somewhere. We hired a year ago, we hired in our department a circular economist, and her whole research area is looking at that. Really, what are we gonna do with products instead of putting them in the landfill? And your colleague was absolutely right. You know, right now we have a linear economy. You know, we think nothing of our cell phone breaks, we throw it in the garbage. Our computer breaks, we throw it in the garbage. And our homes, you know, our homes break, you know, take them down to the, you know, dump, you know, the construction and demolition. In the United States right now, there's a major effort in Baltimore, which is really, really a really nice project. In the 1900s, they built, 5,000 or 6,000 row houses in the port of Baltimore. And of course, they've served their purpose. So instead of just pushing them over, they are deconstructing them piece by piece and bringing them to a warehouse, separating them out. And, you know, they have, you know, beautiful longleaf pine, heart pine, you know, just beautiful wood and all the old, you know, mantles and all of that. Literally taking everything apart, putting it into a warehouse and selling it. And they're using low-income people, people who don't have jobs, people who can't find jobs, ex-convicts, you know, ex-people out of jail, and they're putting them to work, helping them get back started in their life, and you're reusing all this material. And so you can go to stores in the Baltimore region, and some people will buy this and make furniture out of it, right? And so you can actually go and buy, you know, it's very expensive furniture, you know, 2 and 3 times as much as anybody else, but people buy it. And that furniture will have the story of the whole process of how it came from a, you know, home that it's helping employ, you know, underprivileged folks. And so they're selling the story just as much as they're selling the product. But it's really, it's good for our race, you know, to be able to reuse all of this stuff. Now, will I see it in my lifetime common? No. But I think in the, you know, the future generations, they're going to look at that. You know, the biggest issue we'll have with that is how do we convince architects and engineers when they design to design for the second and third use of the product versus the first use. So, you know, when we build the CLT building that's 8 stories high, you know, not only what do we do with the wood, what do we do with everything else in that building instead of bringing it to it? So you're on the right track. I think that's absolutely right. The paper industry is another industry that's really struggling in the United States. And that creates, if you said, I think you said you were a forester. Is that your background here? Yeah. Then, so, okay, so now, you know, the paper industry takes all of our lower quality products, right, from the forest and from the mills. Well, now there's no demand for this material. So how do we manage our forests if we can't get the lower quality stuff out? Now, Europe is helping us a little bit with that because you're buying all our pellets. So the pellet industry in the United States, wood pellet industry for fuel for you folks, has helped alleviate a little of the problem of our paper industry. But in the long run, I think the paper industry is going to have to make a major shift in how they approach business, is my feeling. But there's hope, Hubert. I think there's hope on the end of the tunnel here.
So we had now some very long-term perspectives. On the one hand, the question of how will customer behavior change? How will the supply of certain species will change over the time? But we also have some short-term developments that are especially for us in Austria very interesting, that we have now major investments of Austrian companies in the United States. On the one hand, the Ecker company is running a new plant for wood-based material like particle boards, OSB and so on. And on the other hand, the Binder company just bought 2 sawmills, and the message of last week was that the first of the 2 is already running right now in a 1-shift version, and they try to extend it already as soon as possible to a 2nd shift. How do you see those foreign investments of Europeans, of Austrians in the US?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. For a long time, and probably for the last 10, 15 years, we have seen a lot of investment from Canada in our mills in our region. Again, they saw the shortage of their West Coast timber. And so the Austrians, we have some Chinese folks that are by some of our hardwood mills. And the, you know, we have a lot of Southern Pine resource. The resource is not really an issue here. It's growing much faster. You know, I think we're producing, you know, we're the Southern Pine in general across the region is growing about 20-25% faster than we're harvesting. You know, and so we have a lot of pine resource. We've had a lot of capacity go on. And if we're like a typical cycle, once all the capacity gets on in the next 2-3 years, that's when the market will decline. I mean, historically, that's what happens. Supply catches up with demand, and then she goes down, right? And but yeah, I think, you know, from an international perspective, you know, we're the largest user of wood in the world. And on average, we use about 1.5 cubic meters of wood per person per year in the U.S., that's twice the world's average, and I think we're about 50% more than you folks. So having a plant located here with a strong demand, you know, that's a good investment. So, and I, you know, as I said, you know, about 40% of our Southern Pine resource is treated. And that's always been a very strong market for us, treated with wood preservatives. So, but yeah, there's, like I said, probably for 15 years, the Canadians, I don't remember all the Canadian firms. I know Canfor is down here and a couple other. And of course, we have a number of Arauco plants in the southeastern United States out of Chile.
Günther, you never asked me how I judged these huge Austrian investments in Germany. But I think the answer is quite obvious, in according my opinion. The wooden market is not a national market anyway. It never has been, but today it's not a national market, it's an international market. And Günther, we gave, with our Virtual Wood University, we gave the answer to that, because not the market is national, neither the education should be national. It also should be international wood education. So I think we just followed the market with our education in our Virtual Wood University. And today with our Virtual Wood broadcast together with Bob, so we have a common international perspective on the wood market, which honestly we have to admit it always has been an international market. We just have to, had to follow it.
Yes, I totally agree on you. And one of the motivations why we started this podcast was that we want to show the young students or the people who might be interested or who aren't by now interested in the first product sector, how international that business is. But I must say, it is definitely a new dimension. So we had Austrian companies investing in the countries around us. And then we had Austrian companies who, as explorers, went to Russia and got their experiences over there. But we still remain on the same continent. And now we have heavy investments in the US, and definitely in the past, one of the hurdles was the big difference in the legal systems. But obviously now the market seems to be so interesting that big amounts are invested over the ocean.
Bob, you talked earlier about the paper industry, and they get the low quality material out of the forest. But here in Europe, and I guess the same in the United States, there are quite environmental movements who ask the foresters to leave all the dead material in the forest as a source for biodiversity, as a source for water, etc. So this will even more increase the lack of material in the future. Mm-hmm. My question is, we face this situation here in Europe, the strong environmental movement to protect the forest, best don't to harvest anything out of the forest. You mentioned earlier that you have the rights of the private owned forest, the law can't make any restrictions to them, or nearly any restrictions mm-hmm. to them. But do you have such a strong environmental movement in the United States as well as we have here?
We have a strong environmental movement, probably not as strong as you have. And again, it goes back to private property rights here in the U.S. So, you know, if you own 10 acres, you pretty much can do whatever you want in your 10 acres. Nobody can come in and cause you problems about not doing it. Now, I mean, if you're doing something terrible, you probably could. But in general, no, you have the right to do it on your property what you want. Our public lands, predominantly, are national forests, which are, you know, 80% out west. Those are the ones that has been a strong environmental push to protect everything on them. But I don't think it's, you know, I always tell my customers that if you want to look at in environmental efforts, look at Europe. You lead us 10 years. My opinion that, you know, we look at environmental trends, Europe is ahead of us by about 10 years. But I don't think, you know, again, regulation is very difficult for the private land on private lands. You don't hear, I mean, I'll give one example I will give you right now. We have a pipeline going from somewhere in the shale fields out west here that they're coming through private land, and they're taking it to government. You know, the government has eminent domain. And so if they want to take your property to put a pipeline in, they're going to take your property to put a pipeline in. And so there's been a lot of protests on building this pipeline because it's going through environmental sensitive areas. So there's a lot of issues in that. And it's a gas pipeline, so there's concerns about, you know, 4-foot diameter gas pipeline, you know, have a minor explosion. So there's concerns about safety issues, not only environmental damage of building the pipeline. So there has been a lot of issues in that area. But traditional forestry, we don't see a lot. of not here anyway. So, no, I'll just ask you guys a question. How is the industry doing in Europe? Is it doing okay, or is it? I mean, our industry is booming if they can do it. So.
I'd like to give, and it's maybe a political answer, because now we have the big discussion at the moment. The foresters see some money for their raw material again, and they come back to historical prices. They used to be down to zero in the last years. Mm-hmm. We see a forest products industry that is obviously making a good money, a very good money at the moment. And we see end customers' prices as high as never before. Mm-hmm. So there is now in the meantime the discussion who is making which share of that money. That is obviously there is value created, and how is this value now distributed? And in the end, we have now a wonderful situation for the industry, but there can be a flashback if building gets too expensive and the normal person in the street can't afford it anymore, then maybe the demand also could go down, or in the end might even collapse. So there are some political aspects in the background and in the short run. And you teach strategy and strategic management in our house in Kuchl. In the short run, they make a very good money, and we have now also a wave of reinvestments. There were no reinvestments in sawmills for the last 20 years. So when I entered the industry, in those years, there were Austrian companies invested in new plants, in new capacities outside of Austria. Now we face the situation that those really old and well paid off old facilities are now remodeled and renewed, because they do that just out of the actual cash flow easily. And this will also bring potentials and capacities for the future then, if we still have the raw material.
And above all of that is this sword of Damocles because of the climate change. The timber industry, they are thinking in time ranges of, let's say, 10, maximum 20 years. I'm, as a forester, I have about 20 hectares forest here, and I have to plant new forest because of the damaged forest through the bark beetle. And I'm thinking of time ranges of, let's say, 80 to 150 years. So it doesn't fit together. You know, I have to decide today what plant I bring on the ground, which might survive within the next 150 years, mm-hmm. while a sawmill invest in a saw, in a new machinery for the next 10 years. You know, these are two different time ranges which will not fit together, never.
Seen in strategic aspect, then maybe you can judge our situation from the outside. That would be nice for us. At the moment, we have initiatives from the European Commission, and this will have an impact on national and local politics in the long run, that we talk about those circular economies. We have the new Green Deal of the European Commission. We talk about the new Bauhaus movement, and one of the pillars of the system is, at the moment, the building sector is more or less out of the discussion of the carbon dioxide emissions. So we're talking about mobility, we're talking about food and how to cope with meat and so on. But from the raw materials to the erection of the building, the running of the building, and then the demolition later on, around about 45% of the carbon dioxide emissions of Europe come from that sector. Mm-hmm. And there is the idea to substitute the cement industry. Just the cement industry makes 8 to 9% of the global emissions. And if we substitute cement and bricks with wood by 90%, we could build up a carbon sink, and we could solve a big portion of the problem we have. Yeah. There's just a discussion about the raw material and about the transformation of the whole building industry, and obviously also the overcoming of some lobbying and of some partial interests of the different stakeholders. How do you see such a development in Europe, or is there anything comparable in the US?
I think you hit the nail on the head here, Gunter. The big selling point right now with architects and engineers with CLTs is their environmental friendliness, their storage of carbon, the potential for recyclability. And so all of those things, and you know, you have to get the decision makers, in our case for buildings, engineers and architects, on board before you even consider using a substitute material. You know, the challenge we face is that traditionally architects and engineers are trained much better in steel and concrete than they are with wood. And from a, you know, from an engineering standpoint, wood is difficult to design, more difficult to design than standard concrete and steel, because those are made products. So you can, you know, basically make them to a standard engineering load carrying capacity. Well, wood, the engineer has to work much harder to design with wood. And so that's always been a challenge that we've had in our industry. But yeah, I think that the movement toward looking at the long-term impact of our building materials, wood will come out on top. You know? Like we have to convince the government officials, and you know, you're right, the lobbying efforts, I think I had shared with you earlier, that the concrete and steel industry have a $10 million ad campaign against CLTs in the United States right now, because they see them as a real threat. So, you know, and they're using the traditional, they'll rot, they'll decay, or they'll catch fire. I mean, that's kind of their big points in their campaign. But yeah, there's, I think that once you get the engineers and architects on board, we'll see much more on the wood side of things.
To come to an end, for me, there is the information that the market, especially from Europe to the US, will still remain very, the one say attractive, the others will say tensed, the others will say challenging for at least the next 1 or 2 years. Mm-hmm. In the next 1 or 2 years, we hope to welcome you back again in Kuchl, that we can have you live in our house again. Well, and the next time you will be able to directly explain what's going on. Thank you very much that you shared the time today with us. I think there was a lot of condensed information in your speech, and we hope that our listeners also enjoyed it to that extent like we did it. Bob, thank you very much for sharing the time with us. I really, really enjoyed it.
It's always a pleasure to see you, and Hubert, it's good to see you. I look forward to coming back. Hopefully it's not a year. I'm still hoping late this fall, Gunter, but we'll see.
We also have you in our plans already for the autumn, and hopefully we can meet again in autumn then. Thank you for today, and
thank you from my side as well.
Stay healthy and have a good time.
You too, guys. Have a nice weekend.